I mean, there's nothing more powerful than just being in true solidarity with people and being and recognizing that we are in this together, and if we don't have each other, we have nothing. And so, in my limited experience in activism and my short experience in activism, it just feels like that is how to be a human being. And so, those are the awards that I'm constantly getting by just that little sense of community. I think there's nothing like it.
And being an outspoken transgender woman in public life, it does come with pushback, and you've referenced that before. How do you cope with that kind of visibility, being in the spotlight, and what helps you keep going when perhaps the backlash gets loud?
Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Sam Assad. That's me, but it's not about me, it's about my guests. And in this episode, I'm joined by Jenny Maguire, an activist and former president of Trinity College Dublin Students' Union. Jenny is known for having a bold and outspoken voice on many issues, including trans rights, housing, Palestine, and the push for more supports for students. We discuss her early life, her time leading Trinity Student Union, and the pressure that comes with being a visible trans activist. Jenny Maguire, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You just recently finished your term as president of the Trinity College Student Union. So I do want to talk about the highlights and perhaps lowlights of any of your time in the position. But before we get to that, I do want to talk about your early life, because from a young age you understood your identity, saying at one stage, quote, "I've always known I was trans," and discovering that term as an early teen gave you a powerful sense of self. What was that journey like for you, growing up, coming out, and navigating those early years of understanding and expressing your identity?
Yeah, I mean, like, I always say that, like, it was everyone else that made being trans hard. Being trans is not an inherently hard thing to do. There is struggle with it, and there is a lot of, like, mental turmoil you have to go through. But, like, it's the additional barriers that are put in place by everyone else that makes it more difficult. And so, like, growing up, I would, like, before I was coming out, I would, like, in the middle of the night, I would sneak upstairs and I would put on makeup and then take it all off and then go to sleep, just because it was those little moments of relief in, like, a time where my body, everyone, puberty's hard for everyone. But then, of course, when you have on top of that, that, like, oh, I actively feel my body is becoming less of myself with every day. And so it was getting to the point that I just needed those little reliefs. And then eventually it became that, like, here, we can't do this anymore, and I have to just, like, live as myself first and foremost. And then it's kind of the easiest. I mean, every day is easier after that.
And from what I gather, your coming out was initially a surprise to your parents.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I came out, well, like, surprise is a broad term. Like, I think, like, it was I was still I would I'd started growing my hair out a little bit. I'd always been very feminine, very this, that, and the other. And even, like, I would only play with the girl cousins, and I would only, like, have friends that were girls. And I went to a mixed primary school, and so, like, I wasn't really thinking about gender. And then when I went to secondary school, my old boys school, it was just like, here, something's not right. And so then when I came out to my parents, like, actually, like, broke the ice and broke the actual barrier that we weren't addressing, that it kind of became, like, as every parent does, like, it's so frightening to imagine, like, if you don't know what, like, a trans person can grow up to be, or what a trans person can achieve, or what barriers are in place, then you just instantly go to the horror stories, and you instantly go to, like, this sad idea in your head. And the idea of that and your child being that is so terrifying that, like, when I came out for the first year, it's not that they weren't supportive, but they weren't encouraging, and they were just kind of quiet about it.
My understanding is that there's a common misconception out there that all trans people experience gender dysmorphia, and it's almost like there's a sector of people who will try to dismiss your story, your experience, as just gender
Yeah.
dysmorphia. Your thoughts?
I mean, like, it's definitely, like, a fundamental part for me of what I experienced. Like, I experienced so much of it, and it was that kind of incongruence that, like, made me aware, and there's suddenly that tension being put side by side and rubbing up against each other. But, like, it is also the joy I get to experience, and just the, it's the most natural thing for me to do in the world. And like now, 4 years on hormones and after a surgery or two, like it just like is not something I even think about anymore. But that doesn't mean I'm any more or less trans. It's because like the cure to that and the cure to that discomfort is affirming care. And so now I'm just kind of like, I barely think about it.
You touched on earlier about being in secondary school. It was an all boys environment, and you spoke before about often feeling unheard in that environment. Yeah. And now in college, you're, I suppose, making up for lost time. Tell us a bit more about that school experience. I'm sure it was far from easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I look back at it now with a bit of rose-tinted glasses. I think when I look back at it now, I like see those happy memories first and foremost, which I think we all do from school. And I look back on the friendships I had and the teachers I had that were amazing and the experiences I got to have. But I still fundamentally was so different to everyone else. Something that was kind of made aware to me more and more as the years progressed, but it kind of didn't affect me any more or less. I think going into first year, I was so terrified of just that space, and I'd never been in a space that was so male and that was so sports orientated and so different, as like as every weird or queer kid does. And so, but then I noticed that, you know, it was a lot further than what the like gay kids in the school were going through. And it was every day just having to be lumped in with this group of people that you just instantly do not feel like you belong in. And so some people were, you know, saying names and this, that and the other, but the bullying wasn't bad because I had a strong group of friends around me who were mostly heterosexual, cisgender people. And so, but it was just people who were sound and had a bit of cojones.
I want to focus on navigating transgender healthcare in Ireland, because of course your firsthand experience has fueled a lot of your activism in that regard. But tell us about the hurdles you faced in accessing gender affirming healthcare. Because for example, I read that just simply getting an appointment was a moment of huge relief.
Yeah. I mean, I was put on the list on my 17th birthday to be for the National Gender Service in Loughlinstown in Dublin. And so that was something I'd wanted since I was like 13. It's something I've been aware of. And then on my 17th birthday, the earliest you can be added to it. And like, there's no youth services in Ireland. And so that was the earliest opportunity I could, unless I went private, which was not available to me. And so when I was put on the waiting list, then, you know, COVID happened, so much stuff happens, my leaving cert almost happens, and then all the regular stuff that we all have to deal with. But then, you know, I had to, by the time you got in the door, it was 3.5 years after I had originally applied for it. And so I sit down and I then had to, it's sort of like a, it feels like an audition to see who's trans enough to get their hormones. And so you go in and you sit down for 4 hours with this mental health nurse, and you go through beginning to end of like, okay, so when you were a baby to, okay, to now. And you sit there and they go through every single possible question they could ever ask you in any kind of psychological assessment. Talk about your sex life, talk about your mental health struggles, talk about this, that and the other. And that is routine in Ireland, but it goes against international best practice. It is unnecessary. It treats being trans as some sort of mental illness. And though, like, yeah, I've had a lot of mental troubles because of the world and how it makes trans people operate and live, but me being trans, like I was just as trans as when I was 17, being put on that waiting list as I am now. And so I still had to see my body change, and so I had to see everything change and still fight every step of the way to get access to the healthcare that just makes me able to worry about the things everyone else worries about.
So over time, that experience you did find quite uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I was there by myself. I was being asked about masturbation and asked about porn habits and I knew that if I said the wrong thing, that I would be denied access to care. And I knew that, you know, if I was not this perfect vision of what a trans person is supposed to be in the eyes of the National Health Service, that we had that I would be denied care and I would have to go private, or I'd have to go through the grey market, which is just a reality for trans people. I mean, I was lucky when I got in when I did. Now the waiting list is 13 years, I think, according to the latest Freedom of Information request. They're currently only treating people who were on the who were put on the list 4 or 5 years ago now at the moment. And so it's just been so the majority of trans people, you know, they don't wait because you can't, because it just allows you to be able to live your life normally.
And you mentioned there the HSE's National Gender Service, and they've come out to say in recent months that they've admitted that their services are not meeting teams' yeah. full range of needs. They say that a new clinical program for gender healthcare is being developed, so we'll see what the result of that is going to be.
Being developed by the same people who currently operate it.
Mm. But you in the past have called for an informed consent model in Irish trans healthcare. What does it look like exactly?
Yeah, I mean, what it would look like is, you know, a decentering of trans healthcare, and like in that currently you have to go to a specialist service up in Dublin. People are traveling from all across the country to pop up here for an agonizingly long appointment, or even just for a short checkup. And so it's about bringing that back to the community. I think something like the National Gender Service should still exist for the people that want it. But for someone like me, who I knew I was trans when I was 13, it has infinitely made my life better. And that is something, that was a truth I knew from that young age, which is scary to think about. And like, it is a big life decision, but it's because I've gotten to make that decision that I'm able to like engage in life and engage in a confidence that when I started puberty was just ripped from underneath me. I was such a confident, bubbly child. And then when I went to secondary school, it was like it was gone like that. And then it was transition that allowed me to just return to being myself. And so it is putting it back into the community, giving people the information of what exactly it is, the good, the bad and the ugly, and what are the limits to it, what are the correct doses, what are the correct harm reduction measures that can be done to make sure it's done safely, because people are currently taking hormones without any medical supervision, and they're learning to analyze their own blood tests because the services aren't there doesn't mean that people aren't accessing them through their own means. And so this is something that is supported by so many doctors and supported by a growing number of healthcare professionals, that this is the direction we should be going. But there's a lot of hesitancy to bring that in, because that is a further liberalizing of transgender healthcare, which isn't very politically popular at the moment.
And if I can ask, where are you at now with your treatment?
Yeah, where am I now? 4 years on hormones. It's at the end of this month, August. It's genuinely the last thing I think about. Sometimes I forget to take my pills. I'm brutal at it. But it's just something I only think about when I'm asked questions about it. And I only think about when, like, I'm putting off getting a blood test or putting off looking after myself. And so it's something that, like, I think about in more of a community sense, because I see the amount of pain that's in the community and how much I am the gold star case of like the best treatment that someone has gotten. And I've still the National Gender Service presents itself as a holistic care model that, you know, it's important that we don't just give, and I would agree to this to an extent, that it's important we don't just give people hormones and then abandon them for any issues they have, or, you know, the social aspect of transition that's so rarely talked about, and the mental health benefits and pullbacks as going through puberties in your early 20s brings about. And so I think they say that, but I have gone to them with some of the worst mental health struggles of my life and then just been ignored. And then I've gone to them when I notice my blood levels are wrong and they tell me I'm wrong. And then I, two appointments later, I'm told, oh, actually, sorry, you were right the whole time. And so this is not a model of care that's working, and it's not about funding. It's about a ideological position of what they think that healthcare should be. And it's about really, you know, it's the same thing we've always been fighting for, and that is bodily autonomy, people having right to information and right to choice over their own bodies.
Let's move on now to your time in Trinity. You're the first in your family to go to Trinity.
Yeah.
Was going to Trinity always the plan?
I was happy. Well, DCU was number two on my CAO because I live much closer. And it was genuinely not because of the alleged prestige of Trinity, but because I loved writing, I loved English, I loved drama growing up. And I looked at all the courses in DCU, in UCD, in Trinity, in every place in Dublin. And because I couldn't live anywhere else. And Trinity looked like it had the best course, most interesting course, and great social aspects. And so that's where I threw myself in. I have a twin brother who went to DCU. And so, those are the two worlds.
You're studying English and drama. And what's the long-term plan career-wise?
Well, there's so many jobs in English and drama, famously. It's something I use every day, genuinely. I think it gives you something that is priceless. It gives you your ability to obviously critical analysis skills and be able to look at things a bit more creatively, but also it allows you to kind of see the humanity in everything first and foremost. And I think that underlines my politics. I think theater and English has given me a political education greater than any amount of theory or anything could, because I'm grounded first and foremost. And I think that's also just from growing up, grounded first and foremost in that community sense and in that humanity first and foremost before anything else. And if it doesn't work for the people, then it's not working.
You mentioned there the alleged prestige
of
Trinity. But Trinity is often seen as the posh university, right? I mean, it's the highest ranked university in the country, and for good reason, as a world-class research there, for example. But some would say it is elitist in a lot of ways. As someone who has experienced it now from the inside, how fair do you think that image is?
I think it is fair, but I think, you know, I think Trinity is like a city in a city, that it's full of every area of life. It is one of the highest percentages of access students, so students who have come in through either benefits for people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds through the HEAR scheme or through the DARE scheme, which is for students with disabilities. And as one of the highest percentage of students, out of the total population, they are doing it. And so there's a really broad group. A lot of the people who are the most elitist I never came across because we didn't travel in the same circles. But being in, when I was SU president and sitting on the board of Trinity and having to just remind people of the basics that people are commuting 4 hours a day and it's so outside of people's worlds. But I think that you also get that in DCU and you also get that in UCD. And I think in Trinity, there might be a bit more pomp, but I think it exists everywhere.
In your first days of activism at Trinity College, you became the gender equality officer. What exactly did that entail and what was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, it entailed just throwing myself forward at a meeting of Coilia, the council meeting. And it was putting myself forward in it. I think four people went for it and making a speech and selling this idea. And, you know, I had grown up in secondary school. I put myself forward for class representative every single year and lost every single year. Purely because, look, I had a vision first and foremost, and I wanted to put that across, and I thought it was beneficial. And so I lost every single year. And so that didn't deter me at all. And I still wanted to make an impact and wanted to try and do something good. And so I put myself forward, and then I was elected, and then I had to run campaigns. I had to do casework of students reaching out over issues over in period poverty, over a lot of trans students were reaching out to me, and so many different things that it really was a great base education. And in that, the best thing I did in that position was I turned at the NASA entrance of Trinity, there's a big sign there that like is used as a notice board, but I kind of turned the whole notice board into a giant poster that just said Ireland has the worst trans healthcare in the European Union, which it still does. And so doing that kind of put an attention on it that helped, that I think was a part of a broader conversation that has pushed groups like Transgress the NGS, which is an activist group, to really kind of kick up our campaign. And I think politicians are now starting to take the issue of trans healthcare more seriously, and to actually see it for what it is, which is life-changing care that could be easily administered, but we are refusing to do so.
Early on, there was a situation in relation to pride flags on campus, and Trinity had said, quote, it can't take stances on such issues. How did that moment shape your view of Trinity early on, and did it teach you at all about the limits of student activism at that time?
Yeah, I mean, Trinity has been around since 1592, so it has done, its decisions are first and foremost made on the basis of trying to protect that institution and keep it going. And it's done a good job up to this point of keeping these conservative ideas and these decisions that enforce the status quo first and foremost. And so that is the beast you're coming up against when you're going against a place like Trinity or any big institution. And so you kind of had to pull people back to the reality and give them a little pat on the head to be like, but you've already taken a stance by nurturing the LGBT students and staff within the university. To not take a stance is to take a stance against them. And so that was something that, you know, it taught me about coordination, about work behind the scenes, which so even now I'm still, you know, I still love to scream and shout, but work behind the scenes, it taught me a lot about. And it also, you know, taught me that the limits that there's a lot of discussion around DEI and EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion. And I think like that is that kind of moment exposed just how fleeting and just how limited those programs are. Because yeah, we can do a pride day, or we can do a pronoun training, but like if the institution itself is hesitant in supporting the human rights of the people that go there, work there, live there, then like there's an issue a lot deeper that the policies won't even touch.
And then it came to you running for the role, the president of the student union in Trinity. You won by a landslide, I think 76% of the vote. What led to your decision to want that position in the first place? And what do you think resonated most with students?
Yeah, I ran for it because it was, you know, there had been a slow build up. And when I was in first year, there was quite a liberal idea of how the union is being operated. And by that, I mean, just it was operating as a representative body first and foremost, but not an oppositional force to the university. It wanted to work with the university and to work side by side, which is great for achieving certain things, but there's a ceiling on how much you can achieve with that if you want to challenge the major aspects of the institution. And so there had been two presidents before, Gabby Fulham and Laszlo Monarfi, who really kicked the boat out and really started to push people out and make people feel more comfortable and ready for a more radical voice. And Laszlo, who was president while I was running, had already done several occupations, had blocked the Book of Kells, and had done the stuff for Palestine in particular and housing. And I had worked very closely with Laszlo all throughout that year and before. And so I thought I was ready to be the continuation candidate in sorts of putting forward an oppositional. I think I ran to say, I think the headline when I ran was, Maguire promises to be the loudest, most annoying person in the room, which is something I still pride myself on. But I think people wanted that just saying exactly what people needed and what people wanted and being on the side of the students, which, you know, I'd kind of done with Laszlo. I'd learned a lot of and how I viewed the functionality of a union, which I think it not just applies to student unions, but all unions, that it must be oppositional, that it is fundamentally a class struggle between like the college the college upper staff, and then the staff and students are side by side, because we're all fighting for the same things. We're fighting for better conditions, whether that's through pay or microwaves. Like, we're all fighting for a better condition that we can all work together on. And so viewing the union as a tool to achieve that, and not just like put on loads of events or put on like give out goodie bags, which I'm all for, but I think we all, you can't have that without the rest of it.
And the campaign was quite memorable, partially because you ran against someone who finds himself to be a bit of a comedian. You know, he ran a satirical campaign.
That's right? Fabulous. Yeah, I ran against my good friend, Rafe Balfe. And he had never been involved in the union before, but he was a stand-up comedian around Dublin, and he just thought it would be funny to do. And I, you know, I dabble in comedy myself. I'm a bit of a clown. And so... Like any good person involved in politics is. And so when he was running, I had so much fun because we kind of played off each other. He would do jokes that he was only doing it so he could get with me, and he was only doing it so one of his manifesto points was everything Jenny says but better, and that was just the point. And so that was a lot of relief. I had run someone else's presidential campaign 2 years before that, and that was really hard. But I, and that was really difficult. It was, her name was Gabby Fulham. She was half Punjabi, and she like was facing, we got so much racism sent to us, racism as Gwelga, that I would have to translate for her and say, and she was asked what it meant, and I would give like the briefest of overviews, and getting constant attacks and constant pressure. Whereas when I ran, my God, it was like a 2 week like improv exercise where I just got to play off this person. And then it ultimately culminated in me and him on the, because there had been a lovely comedic arc built throughout the campaign, and not the most serious of campaigns, obviously, where he was in love with me was the slow arc. And then on the last day, he proposed to me in front of a crowd. And then just before the announcement was made, we thought it would be funny to start eating the face off each other. And that was the photo for ages when you Googled me, like about anything. It was just me kissing this, God forbid, an English man, no less. So I don't know how I'll ever politically recover from
you
that.
You say yes to the proposal?
Of course I did. Yes, and first rule of comedy.
And I'm sure it made for a fun atmosphere, but you might remember at the time that some observers said it perhaps meant the race lacked like real scrutiny or debate.
For sure.
Pay to that.
For sure. It absolutely did. And I think like it made it easier on me. I had ran a, going into it, like I didn't think I'd being for the, I'd kind of made it known I was going to run from earlier on, which I think scared some people off from running, because I was involved with Trans and Intersex Pride. I had a lot of campaigning experience. I was very vocal. I was known around. And so I think that scared a lot of people off. But I didn't want people to have the excuse to say like, oh, she was just elected because she was the only competent candidate. I still ran the biggest campaign out of anyone in any position that was running. I had the most social media engagement. I had the most, I'd one of the most votes anyway out of any single race, not just president, any of the other races that were happening. And so like it did definitely meant physically in time, I was getting less scrutiny because people were also just having fun, journalists included, with like this funny dynamic that we were having. And I think, you know, I think though, as anyone involved in a representative role, the role of journalism is so fundamental to making sure that you are doing your job properly and you're doing your job for the best of your ability. And so that did pull it back a bit. But everything I do and everything I did while I was president was with a wink and a nudge anyway. So I was consistent. So
as you look back on your year as president, what stands out to you as your proudest achievement?
Yeah, I mean, being a small part of a broader struggle for Trinity to cut all ties with Israel was really important to me. And that was something that was a huge campaign. And I was one of the, Trinity had an encampment in May of 2024. And I was one of the negotiators for it. And by the end of it, like there was still things to be confirmed and there were still things to go through committees and this, that, and the other. And I knew I was like the person who would follow on and have to hold it up. And so for the whole time as president, starting in July of 24 all the way to June of 25, that I felt this weight on my shoulders of everyone that ever put into like 10 minutes of volunteering or their entire academic studies on this within a Trinity context. And so when the board ultimately voted for cutting all academic ties and all economic ties with Israel, it was the first university in the West to do so. And so I think sometimes student unions can get very insular and look at like themselves as just like, you know, I have to benefit the students by doing this, that and the other, I have to put on the best events. But I think it's an opportunity to recognize your place within a much broader historical and political history, and trying to just lend a hand in pushing for the amazing work that so many are doing outside of it.
And you've touched upon it there, but in the past you've said that sometimes the student union had an identity crisis.
Yeah.
In that, whether it's a society or a service, when really it's supposed to be a union and we should act as yeah. such. How well do you feel student unions generally actually live up to that idea of being a union in the fighting for students sense?
Well, I'm going to get in trouble. I think a lot of the times there is a letdown, but that's from consistent years and a consistent co-opting of student unions by universities. And so you fundamentally have to shift tactics sometimes, because if student unions are being relied on to be welfare and mental health supports and educational supports and the sole representatives for students in rooms that like students one-to-one in casework need you there to be, then you can't have the person behind the desk who you're trying to represent, the student, you can't have them hate you, because then the student is put off and the student is disadvantaged. And so across the country, that is what we've seen student unions become, and also unions become. We've seen a lot of the bite taken out of major unions, and the major organizing just doesn't exist anymore within the modern trade union movement. And so I think fundamentally there is an identity crisis, but it is not, it did not come out of nowhere. It's being co-opted and facilitated and benefiting the university, but also the government, of course, because the, you know, students have a lot of time on their hands. That's how they're always given out. And so if with time and with energy, like the student movement hasn't returned to what it was 10, 15 years ago, and it still, I think, is a long way off to being there still.
Did anything surprise you about the role versus what you expected going into it?
Yeah, I think something that surprised me was just the amount of freedom I had, which was very freeing and also very daunting, because, you know, you do a full time 9:30 to 5:30, Monday to Friday, and then a million different additional hours along the way. And so it was that kind of freedom felt a bit paralyzing sometimes, and like, oh, I'm being paid to be here, and I want to make sure I'm spending my time right. And that can kind of bring about a lot of imposter syndrome. And I was kind of walking around in a daze for a lot of it, because it was so much pressure. And I think the toll it took on my mental health and my brain as well was something I hadn't realized, and the real effect it can have. But I don't regret it for a minute, and I wouldn't regret anything I did for a minute, because it's better to have tried 1,000 things and have one or two fail than not try anything at all.
I want to go back to how far someone can push the envelope in student activism. There was a time when you and the welfare officer were formally censored by the union council over a controversial sexual violence awareness campaign. What did that teach you?
I think that taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself and my own experience around sexual violence. I'm a survivor of sexual assault. And so I think we exist within this context where there's so much importance placed on personal experience and firsthand experience and believing everything that survivors say. But survivors are so, and you should believe survivors. Even if that isn't pretty. And I think that made people really uncomfortable. And, you know, I didn't organize the campaign, but I was head of campaigns at the time. And so they brought a vote against me as the representative, and that's totally fine. But it taught me the importance of taking a step back and look and thinking about the why more in you're doing something. Why what we did was, what the union did was, it had been pitched to me that they were going to have these bodies and had the word rapist written across it, and then people could destroy the bodies because there was a policy at the time, and that still exists, that allows people who are accused of sexual violence within the university to take a case against those who are accusing them for, like, as a form of bullying. And so that is just a way that undermines and suppresses people from speaking up, first and foremost. And then when a group of survivors came to me and were like, we're so angry about this, and the fear needs to change sides, and the fear needs to be on the rapists who should be afraid. And this is how they wanted to do it. And as the natural theater person, you know, I thought, you know, this is such a beautiful symbolism, this, that, and the other. But, you know, people were really hurt by it as well. And I think both can be true. I think it became a bit of a witch hunt in a way that was unhelpful for anyone. And I know I really struggled with it, but it was something that taught me a lot about trusting myself and trusting those around me, and also to keeping your friends close.
Let's switch to another area of activism you were involved in. When you ran for the role, your manifesto promised a, quote, bold and confrontational approach to the Irish language.
Yeah.
How receptive or not did you find the university when it came to Irish language inclusion?
Well, the university still has framed portraits of Queen Elizabeth in multiple buildings. So, you know, I was dealing with a lot of baggage going into it. But the union had just before I was elected, voted to create a prediction, a position of a full-time Ifigach na Gaeilge. And so this would be someone with equal hours, equal pay as me as president, as the welfare officer, as anything else. And the students voted overwhelmingly for it. You know, a lot of talk around boycott, divest and sanction within Trinity, but the Irish language is the only referendum since the union voted for BDS to have, like, such a high turnout. And so the students really wanted it. And so I could see that's what people wanted, and that's what I wanted too. I helped campaign for it. And so I think the Irish young people now are understanding the Irish language within a context of something that must be protected and belongs to us all. And yeah, we all had that bad teacher, but that isn't an excuse to help the language slowly get minoritized more and more. And so we did, on the open day of Trinity, for everyone coming in to check out their courses, we had covered the front of the big bell tower, the campanile, with a large sign that said, Cawil an Gaeilge, where is the Irish? Because Trinity was in breach of multiple aspects of the Official Languages Act, which meant signage had to be certain ways that you could access services through Irish. And so these were the basics that were being denied to students who Irish was their first language. And so they had that additional adjustment they had to go through. And so over the course, alongside Padraig McBrodick, the Ifigach na Gaeilge, you know, we achieved a doubling of funding for the Irish Language Office within the university. The staff were doubled. We got additional funding for complete signage audit and to completely redo it all and to make sure that it's in line with, you know, basic legislation, which, you know, you'd hope would already be done. But I think when it comes to the Irish language, I think people still see it as an annoyance and see it as a inconvenience or this additional step of bureaucracy. But I think that is that's something we would never expect. We'd never say about the English language, or when we go somewhere else, we expect the English language, the idea that Irish is somehow less important just continues to facilitate this mindset of that it is not worthwhile, which is completely wrong.
It has become a divisive topic, and those who push back will mention students will be better served investing their time more into French, into Spanish, because it's such a minority language, Irish, and you get better employment opportunities if you focus on those languages more. But you still believe that the Irish language should still be compulsory in our schools.
Yeah. 100%. I think, you know, we're in Ireland. I think how it's being taught is dreadful. And I think, you know, even for Irish teachers, it's being, like, not being taught fully, and it's not being people are not being given the full skills to enable a student to become fluent through their education system. And so I think we are in Ireland, and it is a duty to protect our native language. And I don't think since the foundation of the state earlier on, they had some good policies that were really pushing the vote out. But since the middle of the last century, you know, the actual effort and drive to put in radical Irish policies that we need in places like how they have it in places like Wales, I think is needed fundamentally, because why would it be any less? Heaven forbid we do things that maybe are just not economically driven. But there's, by creating more Irish language skills, we build up people who will want to access more services through Irish, which inherently encourages more job creation through Irish.
What do you foresee for the future of student descent on campuses like Trinity? Like, do you think that we're headed for more confrontation, more collaboration, or something else entirely?
I think we need more confrontation. There's always peaks and pits in engagement and in the radical action, and that happens all the time in any movement. But I think the failure of so many activists to get wrapped up in this individualistic mindset of, oh, I want to be this person because I want to get loads of Instagram followers, or I want to be, you know, a big name on campus, and so I want to be popular and have my poster everywhere. If someone is coming out from that perspective, then they've already fundamentally failed, and I cannot expect much from them, because if you do not see a union, the student union, as an opportunity to go much further and to bring about social change beyond that, like whether it's like the repeal the 8th referendum, whether it's BDS, whether it's abortion rights before that, whether it's so many different areas, you know, students have always played a vital force, and we are letting down all social movements by not doing so, and especially in the likes of housing.
With all the pressures of student life, rent, job, stress, mental health, which, you know, is a more quieter crisis, student life today seems a lot tougher than ever, especially financially, certainly more than when I went to college 10 years ago. The numbers back that up. Do you find that students are perhaps less engaged now, but just because they are too busy and too burned out to participate?
1,000%. If you're commuting 4 hours a day, every day, how are you meant to engage in college life if you're just trying to get your essays done, eat, have a job at the same time, which so many students do? Like, the student experience is dead at the minute. It separates the haves and the have-nots. I mean, I luckily I didn't have to commute very far. I was only up in Artane, and so that allowed me to engage in college life, but I really exhausted myself and pushed myself out because I was working a part-time job at the same time. I had family responsibilities, and I had all these different things that meant that made it increasingly more difficult to engage. Of course, I like to say I'm a crazy person who's told we'll do it anyway, but for the majority of people, it just is a non-option. And so that hurts all of us, and be able to fight back against policies that don't work for students, to create a better social life for people, to make greater connections. I mean, I've met so many people. The Provost at Trinity College would tell you the most you get from your time at university is the people you meet. And so we are just reinforcing the inequality further and further by creating more spaces that people like me don't have access to.
How did you approach advocating for working students during your presidency?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who worked my whole time during college, I would see that, you know, while I had to spend 19, 20 hours in a job, people were getting an extra 20 hours in the library, or getting extra 20 hours every week to do their studies. And so I was at a disadvantage, and I could clearly see that. And I was under more stress because of that. And so it's something that a lot of universities don't want to touch. I was outright told no so many times from Trinity. And so it was important to me going into the role, and it felt like something that no one wanted to address. And I had already in my job, you know, tried to unionize everyone. And so I was very aware of workers' rights and the conditions of workers. And so initially what I did was I brought it to the National Union, AMLE, into Sna MacLean and Éireann, that they, formerly USI, that they would commission a report on the way universities should be, what policies should be in place in universities to support students who have jobs. Because, and that also applies to students with childcare responsibilities, which is just so much more the reality as the identity of what a college student is grows and grows further and further. And so I did that, and then I helped with the actual staffing on campus. I raised a lot of issues around a lot of students are employed, especially in Trinity, through the likes of the tour guides, through the Book of Kells, through the gym, the bar, the cleaning. The students are everywhere, but they were being paid drastically different. They were being getting drastically different working conditions. Some of them were not getting their basic rest requirements and breaks given to them. And so I kind of, and none of them had any space, any break room or any space to have their lunch. And so I was pushing on that a lot as well. But hopefully, you know, I see myself as part of a broader fight, and it was not something I didn't think I could do in a year, change how Trinity understands what a student can be. But hopefully through the likes of AMLE in Sna MacLean and Éireann, that people can have the tools that the people after me can continue fighting for it to make it easier.
And in saying that, I mentioned at the top that you just recently finished your term. Do you feel that you left the student union a better place than when you started?
I do. I think I left it a more radical place, a more, in times, divisive place, but a more engaged place. It was fundamental. We had the most class rep sign-ups in decades. We had the highest number of voters in decades. We had huge turnouts for so many things that we did, and we achieved so many real things. Like Trinity started to invest in stopping period poverty more. Trinity created, you know, agreed to a rent freeze. Trinity got the Palestine win, and so I think we showed so many areas of how more in your face, if not just annoying, actions can be, and using that as a blueprint for people to move forward with. But there's always ebbs and flows, and hopefully, but I always believe that there will be people there ready to fight, and I hopefully in the people that I got to work with, that will continue.
I'm very, very passionate about what's going on in the Middle East. I want to get your thoughts on what we heard from the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, recently. He's talked about the consideration of plans for Ireland to hold a national day of solidarity in support of the people of Gaza. He calls it, quote, a sensible and good idea. Your reaction?
Yeah, it's a great idea. That's why it's been happening every month since October of 2023. I think it is very just insincere to say what a great idea that I took from a letter in the Irish Times. I think a national day of action would be great, but I would like to see that replicated in every area of society, including in government, who has dragged its feet long enough on the Occupied Territories Bill, who has gone through so many changes. We had, amazingly, Slovenia pass recently that they would ban imports from the occupied territories. But it means that, you know, we are slower and slower to do it, and other people are showing that they can. And it's been purposeful delays and fear and a lack of courage that I think, yes, Ireland has been very vocal on Palestine, but that is all we have been vocal. And I would like to see real action that economically affects things as well.
And on the Occupied Territories Bill, the government will say, well, it's in the position it is now because there's legal hurdles to get over. Your thoughts on that?
I think, you know, Frances Black has been saying it since 2018. She has gotten advice before, and she's been consistently proven right as every day goes closer to hopefully the eventual passing of the Occupied Territories Bill with goods and services in it. And I think it's not, it, perhaps that is the advice they got, but I think there are other factors at play as well. And there's huge international pressure on Ireland to not follow suit. But we proved before with the likes of apartheid South Africa that we can be a leader and we can be the voice of good. And, you know, we talk about ourselves as being a peaceful force in the world. And I think this would just be a part of that legacy further.
I want to ask you about activism. Have you ever experienced activism burnout yourself? It's a real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've existed in it for the past 4 years, and I'm just trying to get out of it. It is something that I actively fight against, but it is real and it is hard to get over and through, and I've burnt out and struggled completely with it. But sometimes I haven't found the balance of having to engage, like, because I care about these issues because they feel a part of me, because they feel like something I fundamentally have to do in order, like, some people get shut down by when they see all this horrible news and these horrible images. In my head, I go, okay, right, what can we do? Well, it's something I could meaningfully do to impact this, or what can I do to be a pebble in a broader story? And so if that is the solution to my suffering, and then also that brings about some suffering, it's a balance that you constantly have to address and constantly try, at least even in words, do better with.
And being an outspoken transgender woman in public life, it does come with pushback, and you've referenced that before. How do you cope with that kind of visibility, being in the spotlight, and what helps you keep going when perhaps the backlash gets loud?
The backlash is only loud online, and I can just put my phone down. When I walk down the street, I have people smiling at me. I say hi to people. People come up to me. I've only ever met with joy and love and support, because I'm only doing it because of the joy and love and support that we all create when we engage in activist work. And so, you know, these people who are given out, and under any article I write or under any video, it's just thousands and thousands of people calling me a man, calling me my dead name, calling me everything under the sun, calling me a threat to women, a threat to children, a paedophile. And that is just so not the world. And it's not nice to read and hear that. And as someone with a some sort of a platform, I know as a 14-year-old, I would go through and I would read all of those for other people. And so I feel a responsibility to go and delete them all. But that means I've read them. And that does have an effect on my self-esteem. And sometimes if I'm going to do like an interview that's filmed or something, I'll think in my head, I'll go like, oh, they made fun of my makeup before. Or they made fun of like these little things that do get to me. And that is just, and that does have an effect. But I think when I surround myself with people that I love and I adore and that I know the truth about, then that's all that matters.
There can be a lot of rewards that come out of activism. I suppose that's where you get a lot of your strength from.
Yeah.
Those wins along the way.
Yeah, the wins along the way, but also the community. I mean, there's nothing more powerful than just being in true solidarity with people and recognizing that we are in this together, and if we don't have each other, we have nothing. And so in my limited experience in activism and my short experience in activism, it just feels like that is how to be a human being. And so those are the awards that I'm constantly getting by just that little sense of community. I think there's nothing like it.
You spoke before about the importance of engaging with difficult topics,
yeah,
even when there's a risk of saying the wrong thing. So in that spirit, I'd like to explore some of those tougher topics with you.
This is the lighthearted part.
There's a lot of noise in the media, in politics, about trans rights.
I haven't heard.
And I do want to ask about the disconnect between that rhetoric and the reality. I mean, one of the most polarizing debates in recent years has been around how society talks about the word woman.
Yeah.
And from your perspective, what do you think gets misunderstood in that conversation, and how do you personally make sense of womanhood in a world that often tries to define it for you?
That's really interesting. I mean, I think the history of women is the history of those trying to define what a woman is and isn't. I think the history of women is the history of the constraints and pressures and rules and laws in cases of what a woman can and cannot do and can and cannot be. And I think that is just a debate that has happened throughout time, and this is the current iteration of it. While also the iterations of, you know, a woman can't be too sexual, can't be too promiscuous, can't be too in your face, but also cannot be too shy. Like, these are conversations that I think go hand in hand. I think ultimately, these discussions are distracting techniques away from the real issues. I mean, me being trans doesn't affect anyone. I think a lot of conversations are constructed that aren't real. I think a lot of the conversations that are constructed and fears that are constructed are unfound. And I just want to pee and wash my hands and get out. And so around bathrooms, and then like, I want us to just see each other as human beings and engage there. But I think a lot of the conversation that's happening, we aren't even there yet. We aren't even engaged with each other as people. And so how can I engage back?
What about another hot button issue is trans inclusion in sports, which has taken a whole world of its own. It's really powerful.
Isn't that so funny? Because like, I know so many trans people. I know one trans person who does a sport. Like, and I think it is an issue that people can zone in on. And I think like, and the amount of attention trans people in sport is getting should be the attention that just women's sports should be getting, because like the amount of underfunding and the lack of supports and lack of pay in cases and lack of so many different areas that women's sports have been systemically kept down and discouraged. And so I think if trans women being in sports is your fundamental cause around women in sports, then are you watching it, or like, what's the story? Because I just see it as such a non-issue, and I see it as an issue that doesn't really happen. I mean, the only trans person I know that plays sports plays for a gay team. So like, these are groups of people that like also want them to be there. And I think a lot of trans people are also afraid of making people uncomfortable. When I go to the bathroom, I like still get afraid, and I go in and I just make sure I keep my head down, and I go in and I get out. I don't hang around, because I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable if they do feel uncomfortable. That's the last thing I want. But also, I know I cannot go into the men's bathroom. And I also know that I've been out since 5 p.m. and there's no public toilets in Dublin City Centre. And so this is the place that we're at. And so I think a lot of trans people are respectful and think and are mindful. And I think this caricature of this big hairy man suddenly signing up to play, you know, women's rugby is just like unfounded.
Can I ask, would you disagree with, for example, Sport Ireland, who came out with this guidance about, quote, biomedical science tells us that there are significant differences between the sexes in sport and that trans women retain some of those performance differences even after transition? And so your reaction to that, and people who try to kind of frame this as a fairness issue?
I think fundamentally, that's all we want. It is a fairness issue. We want things to be fair. And I think trans people also want it to be fair. A lot of the study, there hasn't been a lot of studies done. The studies done have been limited. And some of them do say that there are things kept and there are advantages kept, but some of them don't. And so I think what we need is real research into it and to create sports that are fair. But I think the toxicity around it makes the conversation no longer about fairness. It's about exclusion of trans people from all areas of public life, and it creates situations where trans men are just cannot compete anywhere, because they're said okay, you can't compete with men. It's like, oh no, you can't compete with women either. And so I think it challenges the gender norms that we all still hold. And I think, you know, the likes of intersex people who have competed in sports, cis women with naturally high testosterone levels are being put out because of this. And this is a conversation that isn't leading with empathy and justice and fairness. It's being led like a witch hunt.
And what did you mean when you said that trans has become almost an unutterable word for politicians?
Yeah, I mean, your position on trans rights has become kind of a geopolitical symbol across the world. I think a lot of politicians are using it as a signal to the likes of Trump, the likes of the likes of Keir Starmer, and the likes of so many other politicians, of symbolizing a greater economic idea, a greater social idea, and a greater like political ideology. And so I think a lot of politicians don't want to open that. I think in Ireland, for the most part, most mainstream parties have not engaged with that. And that meant for a long time, I think, especially in the last Dáil, like with the likes of COVID and the rise of extremism on social media that a lot of politicians just didn't want to touch it because their only interaction with it was people screaming at them, what is a woman? What is a woman? What is a woman? And you hear that from so many politicians. And so they're afraid to say anything because they also don't want to hurt trans people, but they also don't want to have people attacking them on the streets. And so I think now people are starting to put their feet down a little firmer in the conversations with the likes of Labour bringing a motion on trans healthcare, and Soc Dems have been talking about it a lot, Sinn Féin has been talking about it a lot, same with Mary Butler's contribution in The Dáil a few weeks ago about her trans child. You know, trans people exist in every area of public life, and that kind of fear around it only benefits those that want to hurt us.
If you had to cut through all the culture war chatter and speak directly to policymakers, what practical changes would make the biggest difference to young trans people?
Well, the issue of healthcare is so fundamental. I mean, it has allowed me to worry about everything else I have going on, including my own mental health, including housing, healthcare, the things we all worry about. And so I would say that this is something that needs to be led by the community and for the community, because every time that a government, I mean, we are just so good in this country at dealing with health, to dealing with the health of, you know, anyone with a specific issue that's viewed as a specialized issue, whether it's scoliosis, whether it's endometriosis, whether it's so many different areas that are just left to suffer and then to get an apology a few years later. And so I think what needs to happen is a community-led, trans-inclusive, informed consent-based trans healthcare model. And that is that provides people with the dignity and power to get to learn and engage in society completely.
You're also co-organizer of Trans and Intersex Pride Dublin. You just had your annual march back in July. Tell us about the turnout.
Yeah, so we had a lovely conversation with An Garda Síochána O'Connor afterwards that we were given out to because of the 8,000 to 10,000 people that were in attendance, which, you know, is a good problem to have. But it's important that is changed into that can be shown into power and giving that confidence to politicians that it's okay to speak out and to speak positively on trans people. I don't think any one march can solve much. I think we have to be attacking an issue from every single side and from every single area and perspective and point of view in order to push the boat out a little further and to make that change. And it was a fantastic day. It was the hottest day of the year. My God, it was so hot. But it was a fantastic day because my mom, who was there last year and the year before, said, there's so many more gays here this year. Like, it was mostly just like trans people and maybe like lesbians, which is like which has been the backbone of a lot of queer activism since the start. But it was a lot of like gay men, and it was a lot of straight people, and it was older people and younger people, and it was everyone in between, and such a broader dynamic and profile of the crowd, because people understood that, yes, this is awful and shouldn't be happening to trans people, but understood that this is a part of a broader movement that is used to bring about unpopular economic policies. I mean, with the likes of the Trump administration bringing in so many different, putting in so much money, and the Republican Party investing so much money into think tanks that are anti-trans and pushing these anti-trans messaging that is popular in the United States, and then using that political capital to bring about economic policies that hurt us all and that aren't popular, like Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, or even in Keir Starmer's Labour Party with the likes of, you know, he got a lot more anti-trans when his economic policies weren't that popular because he knew he could gain a few points. And I think that is the context we need to be viewing this in and thinking, you know, they can attack anyone. Why are they attacking trans people? Because it's popular to do so. But not in Ireland.
When you're not campaigning, when you're off the clock, so to speak, where do we find Jenny?
Where do you find Jenny? Rotting in her bed, out a lot of nights, very active social life, still involved in like different... I used to do a lot of stand-up. I used to do a lot of improv comedy, but spend a lot of time with my dog as well. I've only recently moved back home after being president, because you live on campus as president, which is crazy and so much fun. And so it's definitely a lot quieter than being in a party house for 12 months. And I think, you know, my skin and my sleep schedule are thanking me for it. But outside of it, I like to relax with my dog and surround myself with friends and those I love.
Tell us about your life slogan, quote, existing in joy and living without fear.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm stubbornly optimistic. And so, if someone tells me no, I'm about like an issue, I'm just like, that's none of my business. I'll find the person that will say yes to me and that will keep pushing and try and move everything to get there. I think I take everything with a sense of humor. I take everything with a smile, a wave, a wink and a nudge, because I think, you know, I'm Irish and that sense of humor is something that we're all famous for. And I think sometimes when we want to be all serious, we kind of lose that. But I think there's a great power and a great strength in being the one in the room who kind of cuts the tension and goes against the social norm, because it makes everyone else relax. And if we're all more relaxed, then we can see each other as people. And so, yes, it's just a bit of crack, but also I think it has real effects in terms of bringing the peace down a little bit. If I go up, when I was in the encampment, and everyone was so tense and everyone was so angry at each other and there was so much infighting, and then I'll get up and I'll just be like, start taking the mickey out of everyone and start like making jokes and this, that and the other, then we can realize that, okay, this is about something bigger. It's not about us. And I think it allows us to decenter ourselves and realize that we're all just playing pretend.
You touched on earlier how when you ran for the student union president role that you promised to be the loudest, most annoying voice in the room. How loud, how annoying can you get going forward?
Well, I'm musical theatre trained, so I can be real loud and real annoying. My first job was as a monk. I dressed up as a monk and sat outside Trinity College, and I would have to like engage with tourists in this monk persona. And so I think that was kind of rock bottom for me, so it's only up from there. And so I think I will continue to be wherever I'm best needed and wherever I can best contribute to life and public life and to movements, because I think if we're not constantly trying to push us out further and push against the restraints that have always kept working people down, that have always kept working class people down, middle class people down, and really pushing against that, because if we don't, then we're just going to keep moving back.
Few final questions before we finish up. When you look at your life right now, what are three things that really ground you in gratitude?
Three things that really ground me in gratitude are thinking of myself as a child and thinking that, like, if she could see me now, that she wouldn't believe it, and she would be so proud, and she would look up to me, I think. I think having friends that love and care for me for even when I'm wrong, which I'm not wrong ever. So that's a lovely change. Yeah. But when I am wrong, that they are still there to love me and see me as a full person. And then thirdly, probably my Nana, who I talk about all the time, who just...
A real role model.
Yeah. She like is just no nonsense, and she does everything with a humor, but she can talk to you dead on and let you know what the actual story is, and you'll love her just as much because of it.
I know your story is far from over, but if you had to write the title of your own story right now, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness. I'm a 23-year-old. I wrote a play when I was 16 about getting a fringe for the first time, and I called it On the Fringes. Inspired work. And so I'll stick with that, On the Fringes.
On the Fringes.
And I'd have like multiple bangs in the cover.
And finally, if you could leave people with one idea, one challenge, or one reminder, what would you want them to take away from this conversation?
I'd want people to realize that there's nothing special about the people you see shouting and fighting and organizing, and if you admire that, then you're already 10 steps ahead, and that people like me are not that special, and that we all have permission to try and make things better, but we just have to realize that. And I think like the first step is asking and throwing yourself in. I got involved with Trans Pride because I sent an Instagram DM being like, would love to help. And so it doesn't take a genius to recognize that we're all here together and that we all ultimately want the same basic things, but you just have to be brave enough to say it.
On that note, Jane McGuire, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Best of everything that comes next.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode with Jenny McGuire. If you enjoyed it, give us a like and subscribe on YouTube. You can also follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But the conversation doesn't stop here. You can follow us on all social media platforms for updates, clips, and more. Until next time, thanks for being part of the conversation.